Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
This hour, we're in depth on why Obamacare continues to struggle.
So you've got this crazy system where all of a sudden 25 million more people have health care, and then the people are out there busting it sometimes 60 hours a week, wind up with their premiums doubled and their coverage cut in half.
And I can say all of my employees are having a tremendous problem with Obamacare.
We've got to fix what's broken and keep what works. And that's exactly what we're going to do.
And it does. Premiums are rising. Insurers are bailing. Here in Minnesota, legislative leaders are contemplating an early session to tackle challenges in MinSure, the Minnesota-based healthcare exchange. So what are the most urgent issues to solve? Are they reflective of overall problems with American healthcare beyond the ACA? And what will a new president and new Congress do about it? As our guests join us, I'd like to hear from you. If you get your health insurance through MinSure, how's it working for your family? If you get your insurance through your employer or somewhere else, in other words, you're not using the Affordable Care Act, are you also having problems keeping up with cost? So I want to hear from you this morning if you go through MinSure to get your health insurance. But I also want to hear from you this morning if you get your health insurance through your employer or somewhere else, whether you're seeing rising costs, if you're having a hard time keeping up with those costs. Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. We're online with a conversation at nprnews.org/live, and I'm on Twitter at Carrie NPR. Our guest today, Stephen Parente, is chair of health finance at the Carlson School at the U of M. He's with me in the studio wearing a Halloween costume. Welcome.
Hey, Carrie, good to see you.
Should we just keep people wondering what that costume is?
Well, the staff, you might want to tell. I'm going dressed as the Scottish NHS director with a kilt.
And who knows what that is, but you're wearing a kilt. So that
Donald Trump
clue.
Advocated Scotland as a model for our nation.
Good to have you here, in costume or without. Daniel Dawes is with us. He's Executive Director of Government Relations and Health Policy at the Morehouse School of Medicine, and he's the author of 150 Years of Obamacare, and he's with us from Atlanta. Daniel, welcome to you. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you, Carrie. It's great to join you all this morning.
You call Obamacare one of the most inclusive laws ever passed by Congress. You must be concerned about some of these rising costs in the health exchanges and then what is happening even outside the exchange and outside of the ACA. Are you?
I sure am. And I'll tell you, so when we call it the most inclusive, we also call it the most comprehensive health law ever passed by the U.S. Congress, dealing with the fragmentation and the disparities among vulnerable populations especially. And I think it's somewhat disingenuous of opponents to declare that Obamacare price increases are due to the original design of this program, when it was obstructionists that have caused this result. If there was an argument that there was a flaw in the design, it's that we didn't have the public option to help keep these costs down. When we designed this law, we took an equity lens to it. And what does health equity mean? For every single health equity champion, we know that we are striving to get folks to reach their full level of health, their optimal level of health, and that we're getting rid of the barriers that prevent population groups from achieving their optimal level of health. And so, you know, it's a very complicated issue when you talk about the prices, because the ACA, in terms of its inclusion and its comprehensiveness, we not only focus on cost, but we also look at other key objectives: coverage, access, quality improvement, consumer experience, and public health.
And Daniel, let me do this and bring Steve in here. Steve, it is undeniable that more people are covered with health insurance. That is something that the ACA, as Daniel Dawes notes, has accomplished, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The majority of the folks that got additional coverage got it through Medicaid expansion. And there could have been even more if states allowed that to occur. But that's the predominant way that this has actually allowed people to get coverage where they hadn't had access before. The private insurance market is the other side where we see the premiums, and that's probably the area that needs the most work.
We have an average increase here, Steve, of 22%. And, of course, that does vary across states. Can you put your finger on what it is that is driving a double-digit increase in costs?
I can try. I think that there are several things that have happened here. One of them is that part of the, if you will, the training wheels that were put on this program originally in the law were two additional pieces that have been coming off for the 2017 year. So the risk corridors and reinsurance piece were in place for the first 3 years. They have come off. There were also grandfathered plans that were allowed to live a little longer and compete in the market with less regulatory components. Those were set to expire this year as well. And the combination of those two things, and I've written about this for the last 2 years, we're always going to make this year to be a cliff.
So, Daniel, I want to talk. Did you call them risk corridors?
Yes.
Here, Steve? Basically, we're talking about the risk pool.
It's literally a federal program. Both of these are federal programs that were part of the law in the original legislation that was passed that more or less gave insurers essentially a cushion to get used to this market.
Got it. Okay.
In a different way. And there's a third program, too, called risk adjustment that remains that actually does give insurers more money if they take on a sicker population. The problem is that mechanism was somewhat untested to do this and has not worked as well as it should.
Daniel,
Gary, yes. Can I actually add something? So I'm glad you brought up risk corridors because, you know, this is another one of the other provisions in this law that has been obstructed in terms of being implemented. And only 12% of the funding under that provision has been given to the insurance companies for those who received losses or experienced losses in the health insurance exchanges. So only 12% to date, one of the reasons why we saw a jump of 22%. And then, you know, the other argument I've heard from folks is, well, you look at the co-ops that were also included as a kind of public option. Many folks will argue, oh, look how they've all failed. Well, another reason why we've seen failure there was because of the $6 billion that was appropriated to establish these co-ops to compete with the private insurers. Only half of the money was given to them. So, again, there you see some obstruction, halting progress, and actually increasing the cost.
Let me grab a call here. I am going to come back to that risk pool thing because, Steve, mm-hmm. you and I talked about that many, many times and how that's played out because I think that's had an influence here. But a call from Chris in Minneapolis. Hi, Chris. How is this working for your family?
Hi, Terry. Well, my health care has gone up considerably, the costs. And basically, mine is an employer employer-offered health care plan.
Mm-hmm.
My deductible doubled, and also the pre-tax health savings account that I have, the government changed it from $5,000 down to $2,500. Right away, that was a big kick to me.
Uh-huh. So with a deductible at that rate, and I've actually had conversations specifically about deductibles, how is that affecting the way that you access health care?
Well, I'll be honest with you. I don't ration any health care for my family, but I don't go myself anymore. I really don't. And I never hit my deductible now. I mean, it's basically just cash out of pocket for everything I do in taking care of my family. And I hit the deductible somewhere around the end of November.
Right.
It's become extremely expensive for me, and I just don't do what I used to do. You know, I used to go to a dermatologist for to make sure I'm, you know, I have skin cancers and things like that. I don't go anymore. You know, I just go to my regular doctor as few times as I can and try to jam it all into a couple, visits.
Chris, I really appreciate the call, and you've brought up some things that I wanted to talk about. Daniel, again, to be clear here, Chris is getting his health insurance outside of the ACA. He's getting it from his employer.
Correct.
But we see a lot of Americans who get their insurance through employers or somewhere else also experiencing these high deductibles and these rising costs. Why?
And, you know, so one of the focus, and it's true, from 2001 to 2010, right before the implementation of the ACA, the employer-sponsored health coverage, or premiums, they doubled in that time frame. And so that was one of the issues that we were dealing with. We were looking at the cost of uninsured individuals to those who actually have insurance. So 40% of the cost of uninsured individuals were passed on to those who are insured. We tried to deal with that issue by increasing coverage. And then let me tell you, the other piece of this is that I understand that change has been too slow. Relief has been too slow for folks. But another piece of this lowering the cost argument as one of the triple aims claims is the focus on innovative delivery and payment system reforms. We don't have a good grasp on the total cost of care for patients across the care continuum, across care settings. We need to do a better job there. So change has been too slow, but in terms of the cost reducers in this law, there are innovative delivery and payment system reforms focusing on value, not volume, and that will take time to really help bend the cost curve. And then there is also a focus on prevention and primary care, which we are hoping. There has been, again, some obstruction in trying to implement this prevention aspect, especially with the public health funds seeing decreased cuts in, or significant cuts. So we are working to develop some innovative programs to actually prevent folks from reaching an acute level and actually prevent and use early interventions to keep folks as healthy as possible so we can reduce the cost. So that's going to take some time. And I think, you know, with the next health reform 2.0 in the next administration, I think this is going to be something they're going to have to definitely tackle.
We'll talk about that. And Steve, I know in the course of the years that this may or may not be in effect, we are still in kind of early days here. But the idea was supposed to be that we would see some cost and premium reductions because people would have health insurance, they'd stop going to the emergency, you know, all of these reasons that we might see a chipping away at these high premiums. It's been just the opposite. Why?
It's been the opposite because there's just some fundamental facts that have been going wrong for a long time. Healthcare just goes up at a faster rate of inflation, and it has been for the last 60 years or so.
In this country, not in all countries. So why here?
Because we don't have an explicit budget on it. We don't have a central command and control budget aspect on healthcare in the NHS, whether it's Scotland or the UK, they do have a very explicit budget. They used to have a very explicit budget target to a percent of GDP per year. We just don't do that. We do it somewhat in pieces of our system in the VA and other components, but not generally in our system here. Most people in the United States who are under the age of 65 get their insurance through their employer. There is nothing explicit about their employers being held to any particular cost increases year over year, or for that matter, if they go self-insured benefit design. There's nothing that says they can't make a deductible at a certain level too high.
Can I ask you if drug prices play a role in this?
They always do, because drug prices are a hard thing because it's really a double-edged sword. The reason why the costs are high is that they're usually paying for a brand new drug that has to recover whatever it had for R&D expenses to get out.
The research and development that's gone into it. Yeah.
And then on top of that, it also pays for all the drugs that came around it in that same drug class that failed. And so that puts the cost very high. And it does stabilize over a set of years, but you know, incrementally, it's always a little bit more. You never get to a point where a really super great biosimilar drug comes back down to $5 a pill. It may stay and hover for 10 years at about $100, and that drives the cost higher.
So are you saying that as we look at these costs, we do have to acknowledge that drug prices are a chunk of this?
We have to acknowledge
or not.
We have to. Well, I think it goes back even farther than that. We have to acknowledge that healthcare, the way we practice it in this country, with a huge value for innovation.
And this is what Daniel was saying,
right,
too.
And technology, right? And innovation. Not so much health system innovation, but technology and innovation, those breakthrough silver bullets. We as a society still look for those, and they are not free. They come at a cost, and very rarely do they ever lead to a moment where you actually have cost reductions in the system.
Call here from Paul in Minneapolis. Hi, Paul. What's been the experience for you with healthcare?
Hi, Carrie, and thanks for having this program.
Sure.
Well, I buy my insurance through the exchange. I'm self-employed. I'm 59 years old. My wife is covered under her employer's policy, but I buy mine because I'm self-employed. I last year, I paid $400 a month. Okay, I'm very, very healthy. The only thing I go to the doctor for is monthly allergy shots. So I spend very little money on actual health care.
Mm-hmm.
$400 a month last year, $626 for 2017 with a $6,500 deductible.
So is it becoming unaffordable for you, Paul? Or
well, yeah, I have to do something else. I either have to because my startup business is not yet producing quite the income I need it to produce. This is a really difficult thing. It's putting me in a position where I have to look at, you know, maybe I need to just go out and get a job where I'm covered, you know, so I, you know, throw this thing away I'm working on and go get a job where I get coverage because it's unreasonable.
Daniel, hang on 1 second, Paul. We might come back. Stay with me.
I wanted to ask Paul a quick question, too, because I think this is important and something that we've heard from folks. And I sympathize with you, Paul, on your experience so far. I'm curious what level plan you have. Did you get the platinum, the gold, the silver, or the bronze?
Paul, are you there?
I'm here. And I can tell you haven't looked on the exchange because you'd know. You'd know based on what I'm paying that I have one of the lowest plans you can get, you know? So, you know, bone up on what really is out there. I'll tell you what, a silver or gold plan would cost me, last year would have cost me $600 or $700 a month.
So Daniel?
No, I'm at the bottom of the barrel. I was at the bottom of the barrel with 400.
Okay.
Got you. Yeah, because one of the things that we've been educating folks about is if they get a silver plan, you know, not only do they get the premium subsidies, but they also get the cost-sharing subsidies to aid with the issues that you presented, so your co-payments, your deductibles, and the like. And so for those who fall below 250% of the federal poverty level, we're trying to educate them that they should try to get a silver plan so that can help reduce the cost in the system. That's just one strategy that we'd like to see to educate folks about.
Well, I think I'm caught in where I'm not in poverty, but you know, last year to get the subsidy because of my employment situation, the subsidy was just way too complicated. And
yeah, Steve, you looked a little puzzled about the silver plan idea that Daniel's suggesting. Why?
Well, just because it works for folks basically if they're 250% of the federal poverty line or below. So, I mean, depending upon where you know Paul is for essentially his income, I mean that might not necessarily work for him at all. There's a lot of entrepreneurs out there. Like if you let's say you were consulting or working for industry, and your income is something like at about $65,000 or $70,000 or $80,000. I mean, my students who graduated with an MBA, you know, start pretty well in terms of at least $100,000 on average. None of what essentially would be offered in the exchange if they wanted to go out and be an entrepreneur coming out with an MBA, they'll take advantage of. They're going to be facing the exact same premium structure coming in as Paul would.
How much of this, Steve, is about the fact that the insurers themselves did not do the right kind of estimation about what it was going to mean to participate in these exchanges, the costs that they were going to have to absorb, the kind of plans that they were going to offer? Is there some of that for this?
There is definitely some of that. I mean, to be fair, the insurers never really faced a game, if you will, like this, or a set of rules that were offered by the ACA.
So you're saying they didn't really know what they were getting into?
Correct. And they're actually, I remember actually working with folks on HHS, where they literally retained Deloitte Germany, who normally runs NATO simulation war games, to actually try this out with the health plans and the actuaries, just to see how well the health plans would adapt to the new rules. They pretty much failed. And that is, you saw it in that, and that was a year before the law was fully deployed in 2014. So we kind of knew a preview, but we didn't expect how bad it could be. So in our case in Minnesota, we had situations where plans would try to say, you know, offer a really low premium, get as many people insured as they possibly could, not recognizing that they might basically bankrupt themselves in the process.
Which is why some of them pulled out, right, of the exchange. And Daniel, here's the other question before we go back to calls. When this was coming together, the makeup of the risk pool was really important. And you know that President Obama went around trying to, and I think is still doing this, went around trying to persuade young, what they think of as invincibles, to get into the pool. What we now know, that 28% of the risk pool are 18 to 34-year-olds, and that number, to make this work, needed to be somewhere around 35%. Is that part of what's going on?
That is a significant part of why we have seen an increase in costs, and you're absolutely right. We are continuing to work, especially in states where we have seen the lowest enrollment of healthy or younger people, getting them into the exchanges, because what we have noticed, and I mean, you know, it shouldn't be a surprise to many, there for generations we've had folks, lower socioeconomic status individuals, who did not have access to care, who did not have coverage, and so we did know they were going to be sicker. We had an idea while we were working on this law. But now we've got to make sure that we continue to push and educate and inform and enroll as many younger and healthier folks as possible. And that's what we're doing with Families USA and other organizations across the country.
Kevin says on Twitter, on COBRA paying list price, ACA costs increasing, employer health care costs increasing, common thread. Insurance companies. Marit says $450 a month, expensive, but my medical condition can cost $60,000 a year. I bought a gold plan. COBRA was $1,000 a month, $5,000 deductible. So that's actually working out for her and her situation. Right. Steph off the page.
Dana in Bemidji says, I had a baby 3 years ago. It cost me about $3,000 out of pocket. I had a baby this year and it cost me $7,000. And my routine ultrasounds and labs were not covered. I did not do some testing that was recommended because I was already paying so much more and subsequently had less peace of mind that my baby was okay while pregnant this time. And Julia said, I insured my son on the exchange because we couldn't afford either of the family plans offered at our employers, but now his premium is going up 50%.
Wow. Steve, one more question here on the risk pool. What if the efforts that are being made right now, again, to get some of these younger people who are going to face fines, as we've acknowledged, if they don't get health insurance, what if that number, you know, maybe 28%, I said it edges up to 30%. It never gets to that 35%. What happens to all this?
It gets worse. I mean, we're
you mean cost-wise?
Cost-wise, it gets worse because, I mean, essentially you have proportionately more and more sicker and older people that are in the market. You need to essentially get those folks back into the market somehow. This is going to be a question that's going to have to come up probably for the next administration. I know you want to talk about that. But, I mean, there are ways you can change the regs, but they're going to require either executive order at a minimum, but most likely a change in legislation to fix these things.
Why?
Because one of the biggest reasons why by young folks aren't coming in is simply economics. It's too expensive for them. Before the ACA, there was not an explicit regulation, at least nationally, about what the ratio was in terms of how far the spread would be between the highest and the lowest.
So explain that, what you're
okay.
saying.
So generally the way insurance works is just you have a risk and you're assigned essentially a premium based upon your risk in terms of what's there. One way you can ensure that the market is a little more fair is you can have everyone pay the exact same amount. That's what largely employer-sponsored coverage does.
Right.
That's a one-to-one ratio, okay? If you actually then say, well, that's not very fair necessarily for someone to pool all their risk together, let's make it a different ratio, which is what the law had, 3-to-1, a 3 times multiple, so that, say, someone now, let's say if they were, it used to be that if they were, say, age 55, they would have maybe paid a premium of about $1,000. Now, because they're spreading that out a little bit more, they might be seeing a premium that's, say, down to $600. The flip side is the person that's younger that would have originally had a premium like $200 is now paying $400, $500.
If you're on the other end of that spectrum,
exactly.
This is not looking like a deal to you.
Right. So if you wanted the youth to come in, a 3-to-1 ratio is not the way to go. The way the ratio was in its natural state was 5-to-1 to 6-to-1. If people let it return to that, the youth might come back.
Steve Parente Daniel, go right ahead.
Sure. So, Carrie, I actually wanted to chime in on the folks that talked about maternity coverage.
Okay.
And I know you've been focusing on costs, but, you know, in this law, what folks need to also remember is that they are getting some essential health benefits that they never had. And maternity coverage was a huge deal for women in the individual market. In fact, 90% of women before the ACA, 90% of women who had insurance through the individual market realized that they didn't have maternity coverage until they got pregnant and they went to get maternal care, right? And so, you know, that is a huge deal for those who are, you know, mental health champions, those who have a mental health issue. Again, the ACA not only extended protections for folks in terms of insurance discrimination for these individuals in providing parity across the board, but it also required that mental health coverage and addiction disorder coverage mm-hmm. be a part of an essential health benefit in this law. And of course, that will add to the cost of the bill. But now everyone can rest assured that they have 10 essential health benefits.
I think what you've said, Daniel, is really important. And I know it gets lost in the politics of this. There is more coverage not just more people being covered, but there is more coverage available to people. And people say,
right.
Well, if I don't need that, then why do I have to pay for it? Well, that's kind of how the risk pool works, right?
That's
to
right.
provide more
it.
Coverage. And I know that gets lost. Daniel Dawes is one of our guests this morning as we talk about where the ACA is today. I also want to talk about some of the fixes that are being, we've brought up a couple of them here. They're being discussed for the next administration. He is a executive director of government relations and health policy at Morehouse School of Medicine and the author of 150 Years of Obamacare. And Steve Parente, a familiar voice here at Minnesota Public Radio when we talk about health policy, chair of health finance at the Carlson School at the U of M. I'm asking you this morning and hearing from a lot of you on the specifics of this, how your health insurance works if you get it from the exchange, the MinSure exchange here in Minnesota, or whatever state you're listening in. And if you get insurance through your employer, how is this working affordability-wise for you? Are you seeing your premiums go up? Are you accessing more coverage for your family? I mean, are you also getting the benefit of higher and wider health insurance? Talk to me about the bottom line for your family when it comes to health insurance. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Here's Greg. He says on Twitter, I'm 24. It's not that I don't want health insurance, but a $3,000 deductible at $190 a month isn't feasible or worth it. Steve, this is what you were saying a minute ago.
Yep. It's a common refrain, and particularly if it doesn't seem like you really need it. I mean, if you're 24, you really don't probably, unless you have a major chronic condition that you've been struggling with, it's probably not something you really need. What thing you have to consider, though, is that even if you never use that deductible,
right,
you should get that insurance if you can, because there's a negotiated price list that comes across for all services if you have insurance. So even if you never hit that deductible, whatever you have under the deductible is a negotiated price that usually now is a factor of 7 or 8 more if you go without insurance.
Give us a real example. Let's say Greg is going in to the doctor for something specific.
Sure.
Now, what do you mean by this negotiated price effect?
The easiest illustration is, let's say, Doug's playing around, breaks his arm, goes into the ER, gets it fixed. If he doesn't have insurance, the charges he's going to face for that, including the PT and other stuff that's going to come along with that, could probably stack up close to about $25,000. If, on the other hand, he actually had insurance, it's going to come in at about $1,500.
So, Greg, even if you don't hit your deductible and you're paying some of the costs, you're getting the benefit of health insurance because you're paying lower costs even under the deductible.
Right.
Right?
Think of insurance as a BJ's wholesale club.
What's that?
At the very little, at the very least.
Right.
Okay, to the phones to Monica in Minneapolis. Hey, Monica, hi. Thanks so much for waiting.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Okay.
So my husband changed jobs at the beginning of the summer, and we were on his plan, but his new plan was not affordable for our family at all. So my daughter and I waited for my daughter to so we could open enroll her into get insurance during the open enrollment period. But what I'd really love to see, we're going to continue not insuring me, and what I'd really love to see is the taking away of the tax consequences for choosing not to be insured. And also, it might help if we could have, for small employers, the ability to pay the premiums on the behalf of their employees through some sort of check deduction, where the employees find their own plans, but the employer pays them on their behalf.
Yeah, Monica,
I
want to go.
Pays them, but take the deduction from their check.
I understand that. I want to go back to what you said at the beginning, which is your family is uninsured. You're going to remain uninsured. Is that right?
Yeah.
Does that keep you up at night? I mean,
no, not in the slightest. I did get a tattoo that says DNR. But,
okay. That's your health care plan right there, DNR?
Yeah.
How can I ask what range age you are?
I'm under 50.
Okay.
But over 30.
Daniel, that's a tough calculation that family's making here. The ACA is not working for that family.
You know, no doubt about that is a very serious issue in not getting the insurance because of the cost. And she raised the issue of the tax consequences and getting rid of that. And we know that The individual mandate was one that the insurance lobbyist and employer groups fought very diligently to include to ensure that the risk pool would be as robust as possible. But here's where I think it is failing anyway, and I don't even know if we necessarily have to get rid of it. There have been so many exceptions to the individual mandate. And so, you know, if you fall within one of those exceptions, you don't even have to pay the penalty to begin with anyway.
I didn't know that, that there were that many exceptions.
Yes, several exceptions. If you fall below 9.5% of the tax filing threshold, if you are a member of an American Indian tribe, if you have a religious objection, et cetera, et cetera. So there are several exceptions to the rule, and many folks are finding those loopholes, so you don't even have to pay the tax honestly.
The only concern about this, I guess, and this is always the thing that bothered me about the individual mandate, is the only mechanism the federal government has to enforce it is through taxes. And so basically what's going to happen is for that to happen, you have to have a really good either tax software that's going to help you identify that and verify it, or it's going to be something that's going to be assessed after you send your 1040. I mean, this gets a lot messier now when you have the individual mandate not be a casual fine, but essentially be part of the IRS.
What do you think they'll do with the individual mandate, Steve?
Oh, that's a big...
In the reform debate?
The question is how that reform debate will come together. It depends on who wins. And then it depends even on who wins, what version of what candidate's plan shows up, which version of Hillary shows up, which version of Donald Trump shows up. There's a lot of variation on those questions.
Anne McIntosh, who's a physician, has been tweeting through this, and she says to our conversation about the risk pool, exactly right. Asking people to pay for others' care, they don't want to. We need a bigger conversation and to get the politics out. Steph, off the page.
Phil says, my wife's employer didn't offer insurance prior to the ACA. Now they do because they have to under the ACA. This allowed me to leave my job and start my own company. Good news. However, the premiums under my own old plan were $600 per month for our family and a $2,000 deductible. Now we pay over $1,200 per month and have a $7,000 deductible. MNsure would be the same rate, but a $13,000 deductible. Ouch.
Wow. Yeah. And Steve, somebody tweeting back to you, Paul here says, climbing drug costs not tied to innovation, as your guest believes. High profits and saturation television ads show the R&D claim is weak. What would you say?
That it's a mixed answer on that. There was a strategic decision. The caller's right. Paul's right. In the sense that, but it goes back 20 years or so. And actually, I teach this in my class too. It's at a certain point the drug companies knew that they did not have enough in pipeline to sustain the revenues that they would need to get their R&D spend back. And that's when they amped up their advertising dollars with the hope of trying to keep the revenue cycle going enough to have enough products get out into the R&D cycle. So that's correct.
Wow. Steve Parenti, Daniel Dawes with us this morning as we talk about the Affordable Care Act, what's also happening with costs outside of getting your insurance through the state exchanges or through the federal exchange. And I'm asking you about what you're seeing, your own pocketbook, your own kitchen table economics here when it comes to health insurance. Right back to the conversation in just a minute to Phil Picardi now with news. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Carrie. Donald Trump's campaign manager says Trump won't make the FBI's new email discovery the centerpiece of the last stage of his campaign against Hillary Clinton. FBI Director James Comey notified Congress on Friday that investigators were examining whether newly discovered emails may be relevant to the dormant investigation of Clinton's use of private emails while Secretary of State. Trump over the weekend used the development to hammer relentlessly at Clinton as the campaign enters its final week. But campaign manager Kellyanne Conway this morning told MSNBC Trump plans to focus on health care, the fight against the Islamic State group, and job creation the last week. It's not clear what the emails say. Clinton has said Comey should provide more details. An Iraqi officer in the last village east of Mosul says residents there have hung up white flags on buildings and from windows in a sign that they would not resist special forces entering to drive out Islamic State fighters. The officer says troops are asking the villagers to stay inside their homes as the Iraqi forces move through the streets. It's a precaution against potential suicide bombers, a common Islamic State tactic. And potential jurors are arriving at the courthouse in Charleston, South Carolina, to hear the case of a white former police officer charged in the shooting death of an unarmed black motorist. Court officials say 188 potential jurors were scheduled to report this morning for a juror roll call, with questioning of individual jurors expected to begin this afternoon. Officials anticipate that it will take at least 2 days to seat a jury to hear the case of Michael Slager. He is facing 30 years to life in prison if convicted of murder in the shooting death of 50-year-old Walter Scott last year. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:41.
On our Monday, All Things Considered, why the Nature Conservancy recommends the Twin Cities add to its urban tree canopy to combat climate change. I'm Tom Cran. That and all the news from Campaign 2016. Join me weekdays starting at 3.
I know you've got a lot of things to do, places to go, people to see in your day, and you can't always listen for our in-depth conversations all the way through. You can find them on the podcast. What are people listening on the podcast to right now? What It Means to Be an American with Princeton theologian Eddie Gloud, love warrior Glennon Doyle Melton. It's a conversation you have to hear, all on the podcast. Search NPR News with Carrie Miller on iTunes.
Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported in part by our members and by the General Mills Foundation, strengthening communities around the globe through philanthropy and employee volunteerism.
Support for Minnesota Public Radio comes from Half Price Books, offering a broad selection of new releases, bestsellers, classics, and collectibles. Information about store events, the email list, and more at neighborhood stores or at halfpricebooks.com.
Back to our conversation this hour, we're talking about the ACA. Daniel Dawes with us from Morehouse and the author of 150 Years of Obamacare. Steve Parente with us from the Carlson School, where he's chair of health finance. A tweet here from a listener, Stephanie, who says, my husband's insurance would cost $600 plus a month on my union-backed employer's plan, and it's $240 a month through the ACA. For us, it works. To the phones, to Jennifer in Minneapolis. How does it work for you, Jennifer? Hi.
Good morning, Carrie. My husband and I are self-employed, and we have a family of four. Our insurance premiums, we buy a bronze plan with a high deductible.
Mm-hmm.
They've increased 60% from 2016 to 2017. So our premiums alone are over $20,000 in a year, and our deductible for our family is $1,300. So before we see any benefit from our plan except for a well visit, we're out over $30,000 before anything's covered on our plan.
I was going to say that deductible didn't sound too bad, but then when you put that up against what you're paying monthly for the plan, that is a lot of money. What are you going to do?
Well, we have no choice but to buy it. The other big change is that we had an open access network. So my daughter, who's in college and not living in the metro area, could see a doctor on her college campus if she needed to.
Uh-huh.
And there is not an open access plan available on the individual market that I can find. They're only HMO and PPO.
Mm-hmm.
So if she needed to see a doctor out of state, it would be considered out of network. And so we are limited. There's no way we can keep all of our doctors. So my dermatologist was part of health, like Park Nicollet. My family practice doctor was part of Allina, and
okay.
I can no longer see both.
Let me do this. Steve Parente here listening to your situation, and you're thinking what, Steve?
Well, I guess a few things. I mean, one thing to keep in mind is that I know with some of the plans, they're not putting the national networks in place. You should at least, because it sounds like you don't have many choices here, you at least should look at what the out-of-network coverage is. I have kids actually that are out of state, too, with same sorts of issues. I mean, sometimes the out-of-network doesn't mean they're not covered. It just means they're not covered fully, and there might be a certain proportion or coinsurance you're going to be more accountable for if they go out-of-network. But that should be something you should take a look at just to make sure you have some coverage for them, given where your deductible structure is.
Right. And the individual deductible increases if it's out of network to $10,000 per person and $20,000 for the family. And then it's only expenses are covered 50%.
Yeah.
So
wow.
You'd only use it if it was some kind of an emergency.
Yeah.
Question here, Steph, off the page.
Yeah, Sharon in St. Paul says, insurance companies have effectively eliminated competition by making it illegal to offer insurance over state lines. This has been so great for profits that they are now divvying up Minnesota. If you live in Metro, this plan, Arrowhead, that plan. Criminals, she says.
Okay. And to the phones, to Anna in Medicine Lake. Hi, Anna.
Hey, good morning. I'm calling. I'm a single woman, 44, and I am facing, just like many others are facing on calls this morning, this medical health insurance situation. My premiums this year, I'm self-employed and 44, going up 53%. It is almost half of my monthly rent.
Wow.
It is more than a car payment, and I'm not able to afford it. My plan's deductible is $6,800. I'm on the lowest possible tier that my carrier, my health insurance, offers, and there's nothing cheaper. As far as on the Minsure market, I missed the cut by a dollar. So as a single woman, 44, self-employed, insurance is unaffordable. It's not budget-friendly, and you can't really attend the doctor because if you go, it goes towards the deductible.
Although Anna, you're exactly the kind of American citizen who, you know, you'd be going for wellness, you'd be getting ahead of, you're exactly who ought to be in that risk pool to make it work. Daniel, are there reforms on the table that would address what's going on with Anna?
Oh, my goodness. Absolutely. So, you know, one of the things I just wanted to step back 1 minute and you know, talk about what Monica and Sharon and Anna have now been saying in terms of the unaffordability. And there's another option for folks that we haven't discussed. And it's this option of a federally qualified health center. I actually get my care, my oral and primary care, from a federally qualified health center. And I know that you all have outstanding community health centers out there. Open Cities Healthcare Center is one of them. And, you know, for those who find that they cannot afford the insurance through Minnesota Shore or are not able to get Medicaid, the community health centers provide care on a sliding fee, on a sliding scale. So depending on your income, you can go there and get affordable health care. That is the gold standard for primary care. So I want folks to know that that is an option for them. Now, when you talk about options that are on the table and things that we are now working, I'm specifically working with the Clinton administration and others who are pro-health reform champions in Congress. We're going to look at now this issue of increasing coverage to those 55 and older. We're going to be working to get a public option to compete in these health insurance exchanges so that folks can get some affordable care. And, you know, we're not saying that, you know, you should have a single payer system. I'm not advocating for that. But we do believe that a public option, just like we see with Medicare Advantage plans, with the private plans, and how they've been able to work with traditional Medicare, we believe that we can have a similar program in place in the exchanges so that we can lower the cost. And as we are working to rectify these issues that many of your callers have highlighted today, I think there are several options in the interim if folks are amenable to them.
Steve,
so just some thoughts.
Yeah, no, Daniel, thanks very much for outlining that. It's something I wanted to get to. What would the cost of that be, Steve? And, you know, there'd be a pretty large appropriation for that, wouldn't it?
There'd be a very large appropriation for that. So I think it's coming out sometime this week. I'm one of the academic co-chairs for a thing called the Center for Health and Economy. We've scored the Trump plan showing that 18 million people would lose coverage under the version of Trump that's out there now. We have a score coming out for candidate Clinton's plan that pretty much says there are going to be 8 million people that are going to get coverage that don't have it now. So that's good news to Daniel's point. But the additional cost will be about $1 trillion over 10 years. So it can become a political discussion about whether we want to make that investment. Granted, the uninsured rate goes down, but it doesn't come free.
It paid for how? I mean, does she have a mechanism in the, besides saying something like I'm taxing the wealthy or I'm getting rid of waste? I mean, is there a real mechanism to pay that cost?
Some of it is. We actually do count some reduction in waste, fraud, and abuse, but that generally gets you maybe at best about $100 billion of that.
Mm-hmm.
but most of it has to come through some new tax revenue component of what's there. We assume that it would be, you know, some additional increase for folks at higher incomes. But we don't model the tax policy out. We just basically cost how much it's going to cost.
Daniel, what about the cost of that?
You know, that's a valid point. I'm glad Steve brought that up. For us, what we also have been pushing is to get CBO to start scoring these prevention and public health provisions, because in the long run, a lot of the provisions that we've included in the ACA and that Secretary Clinton, if she is becomes president, will be pushing is for greater prevention and early interventions. And those actually will help to reduce costs over time, but they're not scored. So we're hoping that they will see that and lower the cost of the bill as well. So hopefully we won't see $1 trillion over 10 years. For that bill.
Are we realizing, Daniel, let me come back to you on that. Are we realizing some of those costs yet? And as you say, they're just not being scored, or are we not even really seeing that yet?
I think we are realizing some of those costs. We've seen the lowest increase or the slowest increase in healthcare costs that we've seen since the ACA. Prior to that, it was a lot higher. So that's kudos to ACA, and of course we know a part of that has to do with the Great Recession and folks not actually getting health services.
Right.
But ACA has certainly played a role in that. I think longer term now, we are waiting for these innovative delivery and payment system reforms to kick in, where we're going to see a substantial decrease in costs
You know, Steve, the other question I have is, we would still be seeing, let's everybody remember, we would still be seeing premiums, healthcare premiums, go up, whether the ACA was in effect or not, right?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Would we see a lower percentage of increase if the ACA wasn't in effect? Or is the ACA having an effect? Let me ask you that way.
We would have seen a lower percentage of increase, but we would not have seen as many people covered. I mean, it's true. The ACA covered more people in the individual insurance market than there would have been without it. But the ACA imposes regulations that will increase premium cost. And as I said, you know, this year in particular, there were some regulations that kind of came off the books that kind of were actually to lower costs. In some instances, it was actually additional dollars. And there's also some uncertainty aspects, too, and that's what complicated this as a process.
Call here from Karen in St. Paul. Hey, Karen, hi. What's
hi.
Your situation?
So my husband and I are 57, mm-hmm. and for the last 12 years, I've been purchasing an individual health care plan from Blue Cross Blue Shield.
Mm-hmm.
For both of us, it costs $1,580 a month to insure the two of us. We have like an $8,000 deductible. We've been willing to pay this high amount because we liked our doctors and we liked the network we were in. The network includes Mayo Clinic, which as we got older, we thought was important to us,
uh-huh.
and also the University of Minnesota. Currently, we both have had medical problems this year, and we're actually going to reach our deductible.
Okay.
But when the healthcare exchange, when our policy is canceled this year because Blue Cross is canceling all their individual policies, we'll be able to buy a new policy, again, an individual policy on the healthcare exchange. But it galls me that after paying for 12 years for a network I like and the doctors I like, that's all going to change, and I'll only be able to get health care through the Allina network.
And this is because, again, this is because Blue Cross is pulling out.
They canceled
right.
their individual insurances,
yeah.
and then they've turned right around and offered new ones
right.
as individuals. It just galls me that a company can do that.
I can see why, Karen. What's the calculation here, Steve, on the part of an insurer like Blue Cross on this?
It's pretty straightforward. I mean, I used to work for the Blues years ago before I was an academic. I mean, basically it's a question of where the spend is and where their trends are going to be and where they expect their risks to be and how can they actually stay solvent. I mean, that's fundamentally what a lot of these organizations are looking at. And as bad as it is in Minnesota, I have to say nationally, it's in terms of choice, it's actually worse. I mean, where I grew up in suburban Philadelphia, there is one plan left when there used to be three or four. There is not much competition left. Public option would help with that, but it's going to come at a cost.
Daniel, I haven't mentioned the Cadillac tax yet, and I wanted to because I know it's controversial in Congress. And basically, it's a funding mechanism for Obamacare that taxes people on high-value health care plans. That helps to pay for some of the ACA, doesn't it? What do you think is going to happen with it?
You're absolutely right. It does help to pay for some of the ACA. I do think that there are enough Democrats who are willing, and we'll see how things turn after the election, but there might be an effort. I think that might be one of the provisions that can be easily repealed as we move forward with the next administration and the next Congress.
So you sound like you want the Cadillac tax to be repealed. Well, how do you fill in the money that it was supposed to raise?
You know, so the way that the ACA is currently funded, you had $20 billion coming from medical device manufacturers through a medical device tax, and we know folks are pushing for repeal of that. I don't agree with that necessarily. There has also been $80 billion coming from the pharmaceutical companies, and then $500 billion coming from the hospitals, et cetera, et cetera. So I would say that in terms of the Cadillac tax, and I can't remember exactly how much of that contributes to paying for the cost of this, but I would find it from maybe one of these other three sources.
All right. Hey, Daniel, really a pleasure to have you on the show this morning. I hope you'll come back to talk healthcare policy again.
My pleasure.
Can we do
that?
Thank you
so much for having me. Yes, absolutely.
All right. Daniel Dawes with us from Morehouse School of Medicine and the author of 150 Years of Obamacare. Steve, a question on Twitter from a listener who wants you to name the study again that rates the Trump and Clinton plans. You're part of this.
Sure.
What is it?
Just if you just Google for Center for Health and Economy, you should find it. It's I think the actual website literally is centerforhealthandeconomy.org.
Okay, and you're putting that out later this week?
Yes,
for sure. The ratings? Okay. Question from Ryan, Steve. Isn't the rising premium situation just more evidence that we need single payer? Everyone blames Obama, but let the insurance companies off. What's your take on that?
Single payer will work, but it's going to be a major cultural shift.
And explain why.
Because essentially it would require us to abandon the employer-sponsored market to a certain extent, or at least basically find a way, carve out a place for it to exist that's very different than the way this country's been operating for the last 70 years or so. There are places that have made that transition to a certain extent, but Canada's been the last, and Taiwan's been the major countries that have really shifted from essentially a private system to a completely single-payer system.
And how did that go in Canada?
It's worked, but it's also been nearly 40 years since they did it. It works on a provincial basis, essentially, where Quebec is going to do things a little bit differently than Ontario.
Right.
It also is just a question of just culturally what folks are willing to accept. Now, one thing I'll say that is possible in the ACA, it actually allows for states to go their own way if they want to be single payer. I know there's advocates in the state of Minnesota mm-hmm. that have a single payer system. That's actually possible if it can be voted on by that state legislature and approved essentially by HHS running it as a demonstration waiver. A state can, if they want to, go entirely single payer and get the federal funds allocated to it originally.
The last time Dr. Zeke Emanuel was here, we were talking about his belief that within 10 years that this idea that we get our health insurance through employers will really be minimal, that most of us will not get our insurance through our employers. Do you think that's right?
I think it's possible. I think a lot of it depends on just the tax treatment of how things are given to us by our employers or where the advantages are. There is still a tremendous tax subsidy that comes to the American public because of employer-sponsored health insurance.
And we should say why that is.
Because of essentially a recession in 1943 that lasted for 6 months, but it was very advantageous for employers and trade unions to have that as a benefit and to keep it going forward. Because alternatively, what that should be essentially is a taxed part of wages, but it just wasn't used that way because of the wage freeze.
Steve, love the kilt. We're always great to have Carrie. You in the studio. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Carrie.
Steve Parente with us from the Carlson School at the U of M. More conversations about healthcare. I see a lot of you tweeting and you still had more questions, and we'll come back to the topic. I promise you that.